formation field. So I will talk about a little bit about feedback from for feedback from star formation histories, and how we can learn something about feedback from observational point of view. So let's just starting from the basics. And here, this gives you some about something about the basic point about galaxy formation in the CDM paradigm. And here, one very important aspect is the formation of dark matter halos. That's because we believe galaxies are all formed in dark matter halos. And because of high resolution simulations, now we learn quite a bit about the halo population. First is the halo mass function, and in particular, as particularly relevant to this talk, is that the low mass slope of this mass function is very steep. How do I switch this on?
The USB into your computer.
What? This is something. Yeah. So this one does not work. No. This is the light that's not working. Yeah.
The light doesn't work.
Yeah.
I think the USB still has to be into the computer for the laser to work.
Is this yours?
Yeah, that's mine. I think I can just use a sticker.
Yeah, there's a sticker somewhere.
Oh, that's here. Okay, go.
Oh, just yeah. One more. Yeah.
Well, this one is good. So this is very steep, okay? And actually, this slope is very generic in the sense that it is almost the same as you go from high redshift all the way to a low redshift. This is all, you know, from simulations. This part of the model is established very well. The second part is that the subhalo part. The subhalos, they are were basically clumps in dark matter halos, like you see here. This is the subclumps in dark matter halos. Here again, from numerical simulations, we know it quite well. This is a subhalo mass function. Again, at low mass end, is quite steep. Okay, it's about minus 1.8. And why this is important? This is important because with these subhalos at a high redshift, they can also form galaxies. And these galaxies may survive to the present day as satellite galaxies. Okay. Now, if we want to compare this halo mass function, basically this tells you how many halos you have as at a given mass, with what you observe for galaxies. This is the galaxy luminosity function. You can see these two things do not resemble each other at all. And here at this low mass end, it's much steeper than the luminosity function. And at the massive end, as you can see, the shape is completely different. So what does this mean? This means that the relationship between luminosity and halo mass is not a linear relation. And in fact, it depends on the mass scale you're talking about. And here, I'll give you another example. So just ignore this. This is more or less the same as before. But just look at this. This plot, the ratio between stellar mass and halo mass as a function of halo mass. If you have a constant star formation, then this should be a flat curve, constant. But you can see the constrained curve is something like this. And you can see, first of all, and here this plot, this horizontal curve here, this is the universal baryon fraction. That's here, okay? As you can see, for halos of 10 to 12 solar mass, that's the Milky Way size halos, the star formation is the most efficient. But even here, you can see it's only one third or one fourth of the total baryons can turn into stars. As you go to the low mass end and the bright end, or the high mass end, the efficiency actually declines very rapidly. Okay, so this tells us this is, must be some star formation physics that changed the original baryon fraction into something that's not a constant at all. Okay. Now, this is a, you know, if you look at the, well, what kind of process can change, you know, can establish the relationship between baryon mass and the stellar mass? For a long time, people think about cooling, radiative cooling. And here shows the cooling diagram. Basically, this is the a diagram in N, that's the density, temperature space. And here, this locus is what you would expect from radiative cooling. On this curve, your cooling time scale is comparable to the age of the universe. And what it says, in this regime, the cooling is very effective. And here, this is not effective. Well, this is a very old plot. As you can see here, you have a lot of cooling that's hot at a high redshift. This is a redshift curve here. And at a low mass, okay? And of course, that's not allowed because in hierarchical formation, at a high redshift, we have a lot of things already in low mass halos. And as I just said, in low mass halos, we cannot allow star formation to be so efficient. So here, something must go on. And people proposed supernova explosion or many processes that can suppress cooling and star formation in this region. And this region I will not talk about, but in fact, just based on this cooling diagram, you would say, okay, here we don't have very efficient cooling. But if you do simulations, you still find there's some residual cooling here if you don't have a heating process. That's why you still need some feedback even for these very massive systems. That's, of course, what people talk about, AGN feedback. Okay. Now, those are old stories, I would say. Now, what about the current status of observation, something that's a slightly different from what probably you learned before. Let's first look at the field luminosity function of galaxies. Here again, this is the number density of galaxies as a stellar mass. Now, we all learned about luminosity function of galaxies is a Schechter form. Then you have a fin and slope here. But now you can see this is not a single slope anymore. There's an upturn here, okay? And here I plot again, this is the mass function. Here things become even more complicated because there's an upturn here. Now, if you look at galaxies not in the general field, but you look at the galaxies that are in clusters of galaxies, this is what you see. You clearly see this is not a single Schechter form. There's many, many more low mass galaxies in clusters. And this is an average result, and this is for coma itself. Okay? Remember that. And we have an overabundance of low mass galaxies here. Now, this is a recent result we got. And here, instead of just concentrating on clusters, here we go to different kinds of systems. Maybe you cannot see that very well. This is a Milky Way sized halos. And then this is a 10 to the 13 solar mass halos. In all the cases, you see an upturn. You have many, many dwarf galaxies, even when you go to Milky Way size of halos. And this upturn is more effective or more significant when you look at red galaxies. Okay. So these are the new things. It's not a single power law. There's an upturn. What does that mean? That means there must be an extra characteristic mass scale somewhere, right? That break this original, you know, if you look at the halo mass function, there's no break, no upturn at all. So this characteristic scale must be produced by some kind of a feedback process or star formation process.
What is the sample of galaxies that you used here?
What?
What is the sample of galaxies? Are it Sloan galaxies or?
Yeah, this is Sloan photometric galaxies. So that's why you can, well, again, you cannot see, this is very faint. This is the magnitude minus 14, R magnitude, okay?
Sorry, are these cluster galaxies or just all everything?
Oh, yeah, that's like I said, this is clusters of galaxies, like a coma cluster, and this is a 10 to the 14 solar mass, 10 to the 13 solar mass, 10 to the 12 solar mass.
So these are galaxies inside the group.
Galaxies in groups, okay. Okay, now, nowadays, of course, with HST, now you can estimate stellar mass function at a high redshift. Now, what is high redshift? Redshift about 5. One thing you notice is that this stellar mass function actually becomes steeper and steeper as you go from low mass, low redshift to high redshift. Again, that's something is going on. It's not just a self-similar kind of situation. Here, this is demonstrated more or less the same thing, except here this is a star formation rate function. What is that? That basically says I have many, many galaxies. Then I look at the star formation rate at the time of observation, and then I plot the number density of galaxies versus the star formation rate. What I want to draw your attention to, again, is that this is the highest redshift, this is the lowest redshift, and this is zero redshift. High redshift, you have this curve that's steeper. Well, we need to suppress star formation, you low mass galaxies. But as you go to high redshift, actually it becomes steeper. You don't need to suppress so much star formation in low mass halos. Okay, there's another thing, I don't know, for this, for me, this is a very, very new and very interesting result, which I must say, I was surprised to see this. All of us know that lower mass galaxies tend to be younger. But if you just look at the color magnitude diagram, which you can do now for nearby galaxies, using HST, this is the star formation history for different kind of galaxies, different kind of dwarf irregulars, dwarf spirals, and dwarf spheroids. And you can see this is the lockback time, okay? Here, this is 50%. What does that mean? And here, this is something like a 10 giga year corresponds to a ratio of about 2 or 3. What does that mean? Half of the stars in all these systems have formed even before redshift about 2 or 3. Okay?
How has it ever been done?
What?
How has it ever been done? Is it a lot of dwarfs that have formed most of the stars earlier, or is it really the pool of these stars that was
So you mean, well, totally there's 60 systems, and each bin is, this is your question, or is it just average?
Is it dominated by some old dwarfs?
No, no, no. This is for individual one. This is the average overall individual history. Okay, it's not just the something here. You know, it's not a bimodal kind of thing. Okay. Now, well, there's a lot of observations. What can we infer from these observations from galaxy formation point of view? You don't want to introduce a lot of pride in your model, so that's why we try to extract some information using some simple empirical models. And we want to see what kind of information we can get from the observations I have just shown you. Well, basically, this is a parameterization of star formation rate as a function of halo mass. This X here, this is a halo mass, then characterized by a bunch of characteristic scales, characteristic mass, and some power form exponents, okay? Generic. Now you want to use this simple formula to infer these characteristic scales, whether you need some characteristic scales both in mass and in time. That's the whole purpose here. It's not physics. Okay, let's do step by step. First, if you do the simplest model, that's what we call model one, that is that all model parameters are redshift independent. That basically says, okay, star formation in different halos of a given mass, they proceed exactly in the same way. And then you just use the redshift zero mass function as a constraint. Of course, then you reproduce this. This is the yellow band here. But if you use the constraint model to make predictions for high redshift data, then you miss it. It basically does not work. And this is you use all this as a constraint, but still make an assumption this is independent of redshift. Then you cannot mesh, and you make a compromise, right? And the first thing you learn is that there must be some redshift-dependent process going on. Now, the second thing, that let's just increase this complexity of the model by a little bit. First, we try to, you know, if you look at this, here, the problem is really at the high mass end, okay? So in order to fix that, then you introduce, well, this one model parameters. Originally, we think this is a constant. Now we introduce a redshift dependent. Well, this is what you get. You get more or less correct, okay? And then this is matched the low redshift, high redshift data very well. Okay, so this is a so-called model two. You match the high mass end very well. But if you use this, well, I will skip this. Now, if you use this constraint model to make predictions for the galaxy luminosity function for cluster galaxies, this is what you get. Cannot work. And this is the model prediction. Here, even you use this as a model constraint, simply the model does not catch what is going on. So you still cannot fix it. Okay. Now, the problem here is at a low mass end. Now that means the assumption that a low mass end, there's no redshift dependence, actually that assumption is not good. Now, we introduce first characteristic time. That's a characteristic redshift. And basically we say, okay, the quantity that control the low mass end now is not a constant, but depends on redshift. And this simple dependence on redshift is a power law with some characteristic change of behavior at some characteristic redshift, okay? Just simple assumption. Now you get everything more or less correct. Then what does it mean? What does this, well, this is not correct for this old data, but also for this new data. This is basically just, you know, even use the new data we have got, and then that's the red line here, you see more or less just go through the data point. Seems that that model at least is consistent with the data. Now, look at this magic, this characteristics redshift. It's about 2 point something. Actually, it's quite well constrained. This is the Monte Carlo Markov chain stuff, and this is gives you an arrow here. This is a new time scale. I don't make any assumptions. I just let the data say whether I need something or not. Okay, now what do we need? You can see here, this is a star formation rate versus stellar mass, halo mass. And this is the model two. You can see this is more or less parallel to each other. But then model three, you can see the change of behavior. At a low redshift, this is a very steep function. Basically, this is what we are talking about. You have to suppress the star formation in low mass halos, right? But then, if you go to high redshift, redshift about 4, what is required actually is the star formation rate directly proportional to halo mass. Well, that's the first time you see, okay, for low mass halos, so you want the star formation rate to be proportional to the halo mass. There's no halo mass dependent, that's here. And the change of behavior, you can see clearly here, this is a redshift, is about 2. Well, that's I have already indicated here. Well, there's a lot of predictions. And we have, you know, I think a particularly interesting one is this one. This one, again, you have seen this observational data that's using color magnitudediagram and look at the star formation history for these different kind of galaxies. And this is the model prediction you have for these low mass galaxies. You have a spike. This is 10 years ago, and there's a spike here. If you use model two, then this is what you get. You don't produce this old population. By the way, this is not used as a constraint. This is just a prediction, okay? Consistent check. I skip this. So, and this one you have also seen, that's the star formation rate function. What I want to draw your attention to is that this is model two. That is, you don't try to fit the low mass and the upturn there. And so this is what you predict, and this is what you observe. This is what you predict, this is what you observe. Model three, this is what you predict, the data, and then the red band is what you predict. Again, this is our independent check. This is all the data, right? This is a comparison with the data. This I can skip again, because this can actually be checked in the future if you can predict or you can observe the star formation the stellar mass function at high Z. And this is, if you don't take into account the upturn there, then you get this prediction. And here, this is what model three gives you. Okay. Well, this one I skip. This is implications for reionization. For this audience, probably people, you don't hear so much about the so-called downsizing, upsizing thing. This is a big thing in the field of galaxy formation. What it really means is that CDM model gives you a hierarchical kind of formation. Basically says that, okay, small things form earlier and the big things form later. But then you can see if you have model three, this is not at all. It's not really just a single relation, and you have something like this. What is plotted here? This is the redshift at which a galaxy forms half of its mass, or 10% of its mass as a function of the halo mass. you can see the stars in Milky Way's kind of halos, that's here, that form stars the latest. And if you go to massive galaxies, many of them, their stars actually form earlier, but that's not surprising, we know that. But this part we don't know, early. And here basically says that for these low mass galaxies, we also have quite early formation. I think I skipped this. This is a, now, this is actually more, now, what I have said so far is based on observations. Now, what does it mean for feedback, right? So far, we have not made any connections to physics. So here, what really happens is that you have a two-stage formation. That two-stage is separated at a ratio of 2 to 3. So what it really means is that before that characteristic ratio, ratio about 2 or something like that, as I have shown you, star formation is actually very, very effective. It's more or less proportional to the total halo mass. And after that, you switch to another regime where the star formation rate increases with halo mass very rapidly. Okay. So that's something actually is very similar to a scenario that's so-called preheating. I think that's the reason why I'm here. Right? That's a, and Christopher mentioned about that. And there's a preheating. What does preheating mean? That basically says, in the early stage, you have a lot of star formation going on, and which can eject material. But after that, this ejected material can heat up the IGN, so that later time star formation actually is regulated by the preheated gas. The gas cannot come in because of its entropy flaw there. And so what kind of, well, here again, we don't know exactly what kind of a preheating temperature we have, but then we can try to use the data and to see what kind of preheating temperature we need. And it turns out to be something like a 100 Kelvin. Okay. So, why this help? And here, this demonstrate these are 2 points. Well, we discussed about two different possibilities. One is the ejection, and that is, you know, if you have a star formation, you eject material, and that's so-called ejective model. This ejective model. And another one is a preventative model. That is, if I have a preheating, the gas cannot come in because of the entropy flaw. Now, if you look at the cooling time in these two cases, and here, this red line here, this is a preheating model. Here, I plot the cooling time in units of Hubble time as function of redshift. And each one contains two curves, the dashed and the solid. The dashed one is the center of the halo, and this solid one is the outer part of the halo. You can see if you don't have preheating, this is what is going on. So in the center part, your cooling time is almost zero. That's because the density there is so high, then you cool things immediately. While in the outer region, then the cooling time actually is not that effective. If you have preheating, these two curves converge to each other. So basically, you don't have inside-out cooling anymore. Okay? So this is one thing that's different. Now, here, you don't need to follow this into detail. Here, this is just, I contrast two models. One is the ejective model. That's, you basically need the star formation to eject material. And another one is the preventative one, red and blue, okay? And then, so the band here is observation, the constraint observation. And as you can see, this preventative one works very well, while the eject one does not. So that's one thing. And you can go on for many, many of this. Again, this is a ejective one, and this is the preventative one. Again, this preventative one works better. Well, yet another example. This is an ejective model that predicts this, and this preventative one that produces this, and the data points are observations. Okay, so this basically says this is a, you know, how many galaxies you can produce in the universe with mass in this range. This again says this is a ejective model, and here again this is a preventative model. Now, well, I hope I have convinced you. People have been talking about this ejective feedback for quite a while, you know, supernova feedback, right? That's ejective, because you want the material first come in, then you produce some kind of energy, then eject the material. What I have shown you is that perhaps it is not the ejective. The ejective only occurs before redshift about 2 or 3. After that, you have a scenario that's called a preventative. At least this is what is required by this observation. Okay, so this is what is summarized here. We have a two-stage formation. Early stage, you have a lot of starburst, and maybe AGN, maybe blazar, I don't know. This is a ratio of 2 or 3, where you output a lot of energy, unbound material that's already in your halos. And then you produce a situation where either the gas in the IGM, not a total IGM, but at least in the proto-galaxy region, actually is preheated. And later, after redshift 2, as the galaxies or halos try to accrete material, it is accreting in a preheated medium. And that, because of preheating, then the accretion rate becomes much, much lower. And this scenario at least is consistent with many, many observations. Okay, and this actually makes sense, I would say. Why? If you look at CDM formation, in early time, the formation is very rapid, and the potential well, the gravitational potential well is built up. And that basically says you have a lot of mergers going on. That's one thing. The second is that earlier time, you have a lot of gas there. So a lot of things are very gas rich. So because of that, then you have probably just, this merger can drive starburst and then drive supermassive black hole formation. So that's the best way to generate outflows. But after that, you don't have that anymore. And that the galaxy formation basically just, switched to a more quiescent kind of mode. Okay, so then what about the preheating source? Here I just do one speculation, and AGN, blazar, whatever. Well, when you talk about AGN feedback, people usually concentrate on quasars and very, very bright quasars, and that's the formation of massive galaxies. But I would argue, if you believe what I have got from the constraint model, AGN feedback might be also important in low mass halos. What happens is that it's shown in this plot, which I did not really go through. So what is shown here, so this is expected black hole mass versus stellar mass. Okay. And what is this expected black hole mass? That basically says if I have a major merger and have a gas-rich major merger, then I say, okay, it produces something like a classical bulge, and this classical bulge will host a supermassive black hole. That's what you get here. Now, so this part everybody knows. This is observation, massive end. You know this supermassive black hole mass is more or less proportional to the bulge mass with a constant here. This is something like the amplitude is about 0.3%, right? Now, if you look at here, this is different now. Here, this is also a linear relation. The same as here, except here, there's a jump. That's just because of the enhancement of star formation that is required to explain the low mass end of the luminosity function. That's this part. Now you can see, okay, let's just use the simplest argument about how much energy I can produce by the formation of this kind of black holes. So that's basically, you know, very simple argument. The black hole mass converted into energy, and then if you use that energy to heat up your gas, so that's the temperature of the gas you can reach, and of course, depending on how much material is being heated up. Anyway, eventually you get something like this. The temperature that can reach, this is in units of 10, you know, 1 millikelvin, this is 1. And here this is some kind of uncertain factors, and here this is, you know, basically this AGN energy, how large a fraction can be used to heat up the gas. Here I use 0.03. And here this is lambda is how much gas can be heated up in units of the halo gas mass. So I use 10. This is quite generous. And yet I can already heat the temperature to 10 to 1 millikelvin. I even have 10 times more than what I'm required to reach 10 to the fifth Kelvin that's required for the preheating. But that's really just due to this low mass galaxies, low mass black holes. So I hope, you know, for this audience, what I can say is that now from observations, we can infer a lot of information about how star formation proceeds as a function of redshift, as a function of halo mass, different kind of system. Okay? There are characteristic scales. And then if you put the in the current galaxy formation model, and it seems that that there seems to be a characteristic redshift that's about 2 to 3, and this separates two different behaviors of star formation. Earlier stage, where you have a very, very effective star formation, presumably just accompanied by starburst, AGN formation, and then actually can eject the material that's already accumulated around these halos. After that, you switch to a completely different regime. Because of preheating, by blazar, by AGN, whatever you think about, then your formation is very slow. That actually is required in order to produce a quiescent disk. And here, as I said, I just much speculation here. If you believe the constraint model, then why should we just focus on AGN feedback in massive galaxies? After all, black holes have to grow from small things to big things, right? And then if you believe this constraint model, AGN feedback in low mass galaxies may also be very important, but people haven't really talked about this, and I don't know exactly, you know, in terms of the coupling of the energy and the mass or the gas, we don't know, but the energy source is there. And the scaling makes sense. And finally, I think this is, for you, probably this is the most important thing, is that whenever you talk about feedback, blazar feedback, whatever feedback, right? Now I would say, now the observations of galaxies have reached to the point where you have a lot of very, very important constraints, because now we can tell how galaxies or how stars form in different kind of system as a function of redshift, as a function of basically the star formation history. I think that's what I want to talk here. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Odin. So maybe let me take the privilege of Jared and ask the first question. Let me understand the key observational evidence for this switch to the second preventive mode was the different slope of the low, faint end of the luminosity function, right? And we have a steeper slope cluster, so the idea is those are crossed from very early in this sort of bursty early mode.
Yeah.
And the shadow slope at the field galaxies, which are the galaxies that formed later after this redshift too.
Yes. Yes.
So again, you know, some of you may know that in hierarchical kind of, scenario, these subheadals in these very massive clusters, they actually form early, even though they survive as a fossil record. In fact, they form early. They form sub very early because of a bias effect. So that's the exact point, is that the upturn there basically says that you need to boost the star formation at a high redshift so that you explain that. And then you don't want to boost that at a low redshift because then you will screw up the field luminosity function where the upturn is not as strong. That's the basic point. That's why you need these two stages.
Follow up. What was the evidence that the sort of ejected models at late times cannot work? So what is the physical reasoning why they fail, why you need some preventive?
Okay, that's a lot of them. I haven't time to talk about this. First of all, what happens is that the ejected one, you need a supernova energy, right? Supernova can only be produced by star formation. So what happens is that, and this is, if your star formation is not that intensive anymore, you don't do the damage. Then the gas can come in, then form stars, right? So that's a lot of gas can come in and going out. Then, first of all, the energetics may be not reasonable. And in fact, there's another very important thing I haven't really talked about this. This is metallicity, because there you have things going in and going out, then everything got contaminated. Then you predict a metallicity of the gas that's too low. While the preventive one is fine because it's, you know, you will not come in to participate in the shearing of the metals produced.
There's a question here.
Yes, just a couple comment from the last part. So you assume that the black hole mass is proportional to the halo or gas, but I think the more recent results show a steeper relation, which maybe
yeah. So that's
smaller.
Something I really don't. You know, basically what we've done here is that here this M star, that's the so-called classical Bulge mass, and you can see it for this again
in the corner.
Okay. So the prediction in this part, you can see that's more or less, you know, because here everything is classical bulge, okay? And the slope here is just given by, you know, the observational relation. You said maybe there's a steepening, I don't know. Then I just use the relation calibrated here, applied to all kind of classical bulges. And what about here, this is a, just use that same assumption, say, okay, the black hole mass and the classic bulge mass, the relation is exactly the same for different kind of systems. That's what.
But then going in the other direction, though, in the longest end, can't you do with a lower gas temperature will already give you feedback compared, you don't need the same temperature as the behindest end, do you?
The temperature here?
The final temperature that you get for the preheating,
Have
to be so high in the longest end.
Yeah, that's a, actually here and here, that's a two things. One thing is that here, certainly you can also produce, you know, preheat or whatever, right? But then these systems are in very deep potential well. You needed to heat things up to, yeah. And then in fact, here, in comparison to the depth of the potential well, actually here is more effective. So that's the, yeah.
Right.
So I'm a little confused. So what you're saying is that a redshift of 2, the efficiency of heating essentially drops in these low mass systems, and they form stars faster relative to the halo mass than they did earlier.
No, that's the opposite.
Is that what you're saying?
It's the opposite, the other way around.
Well, that isn't what your slide says.
Oh, I know.
No?
Or at least.
Which one? No, it's before preheating, the things are, well, let me just show you. Maybe we can have a look at this once again. Yeah, so this is the high Z.
Right.
High Z, you can see this is a very effective. It's more or less proportional to N. This is a low Z.
Yeah, I was confused by your summary slide, I guess, which seemed to indicate a higher star formation rate in low mass systems at lower redshift. But
maybe which one?
Right there. Lower Z star formation increases steeply with M at lower Z.
Yeah, that's steeper because then you suppress more the low mass
I see.
Yeah, that's another one.
Okay.
Yeah. While there is time for one more question, maybe we can switch. Yes.
I guess in the current hardware simulations, for example, we already include feedback processes that cause.